You are listening to Talking Up, an interview show dedicated to authors, journalists, and writers working on issues of social justice, equity, and the systems that make up the nonprofit sector. Guests are talking about their writing and their research and what drives their work. Listeners will have the opportunity to widen their lens and figure out where we might go from here. Welcome to Talking Up, with host Gail Picco, editor-in-chief of the Charity Report.
The deplorable state of so many of the country's long-term care facilities was fully revealed by the coronavirus pandemic. At the end of September 2020, close to 10,000 people had died from the coronavirus. More than 80% of them were elderly people living in long-term care. The conditions were so bad that in Quebec and Ontario, the Canadian military was called upon to help mitigate the disaster. The conditions they found were appalling, and their experience demonstrated that, despite numerous studies, coroner's reports, and inquests over the past two decades, our institutional care of the elderly is often unspeakably inhumane. Canada's award-winning health reporter Andre Picard has just written a book about it called Neglected No More: The Urgent Need to Improve the Lives of Canada's Elders in the Wake of a Pandemic, which expertly lays out what can and must be done to improve the state of care for our elders. We're delighted to have him with us today for this episode of Talking Up. Hi, Andre. Welcome to Talking Up.
Hi, thanks.
Congratulations on Neglected No More. I was so happy to see it on the Penguin Random House spring catalog when it came out. Back in the day when I was a student at Memorial University in St. John's, I worked in an old age home as my summer job. And so I got to know a lot of old people who were in need, who were frail, and understood what their needs were, but also the richness of their lives. And so it broke my heart when I read what was happening in old age or long-term care facilities in Canada during the pandemic. But can you tell me when was it that you decided that you were going to write a book about this, that instead of doing news stories, that you were going to compile and you were going to sit down and do a book?
Yeah, so it wasn't really well planned out. I was getting approached by publishers because I've written several books, but they were saying, oh, we want a book about COVID. We want a book about the pandemic. And I wasn't interested in doing that because to me, the best books about big world-changing events like this, they're written 20, 25 years later when you have the benefit of hindsight, et cetera, and you could put things into context. So I wasn't interested in doing a quickie COVID book. So I was rejecting those offers. But then a publisher came to me and asked the question differently and said, well, what would you write about if you were writing about the pandemic? And I just sort of said off the top of my head, well, I would write about those who were most affected, and that's elders, people living in these institutions who at that time were dying by the thousands per week. So this was early in the pandemic. And they said, go for it. That's excellent. That's what we want. So then we discussed it, you know, how do you do the book? And a decision was made quite quickly that, you know, it has to be done quickly, you know, get out there while this issue is hot. The book should be short. It should be easily digestible and should be cheap. So it's affordable, especially for this demographic, for elders, so that it's accessible to them. So the book's under $20. It's a paperback only. It's 200 pages. So that all these things went into play. And then I just sat down to get writing. And a lot of it, again, is it's sort of a compilation of things I've written over many years. And then I just went out and found current stories of families to illustrate these long, festering social issues that we haven't resolved and just put them in the context. So it's not a book about COVID. The first chapter is about COVID and why that made us pay attention to this. And then the rest of the book is all about what's wrong with elder care and then how to fix it, a kind of a prescription.
It is extremely well written, and it's a bit of a page turner too. And there's some great bits of it that you can take away and keep in your mind. And the introduction you wrote, and I'm going to quote, "Elder care in this country is so disorganized and so poorly regulated, the staffing so inadequate, the infrastructure so outdated, the accountability so non-existent, and ageism so rampant, there seems to be no limit to what homes can get away with." So set the stage for us. What were the conditions that were existing in these homes to allow the pandemic to spread? And then once the pandemic had spread, what were the conditions then?
Yeah, so at the time, there had only been a few thousand deaths. Now, of our 25,000 deaths in Canada of COVID, about 17,000 have been in these institutions. So at the time I wrote that, couldn't imagine how bad it would get, but it was already bad. So to set the stage is essentially what I write in the first chapter. It's the story of Heron, a home on the outskirts of Montreal, which kind of becomes illustrative of this issue, which is this 200 people living in a facility that's chronically understaffed. So even before COVID, 80% of shifts were not fully filled. So there's always a lack of staff, lack of care. And then this virus comes in, and this virus finds the ideal conditions, the perfect storm. It finds people living four to a room, sharing sometimes up to eight people, sharing a bathroom, just perfect for the spread of viruses. Lack of staffing. Once things got bad, the staff started getting sick as well. Right. They didn't show up for work. So literally abandoned. So the story of Heron, when public health officials and police showed up there after families pleaded with them, they found essentially an abandoned facility full of dying people wallowing in their feces, hadn't been changed for days, haven't been fed. They were literally starving to death, confused, people who had fallen out of their wheelchairs, lying on the floor for days. It was a horror movie come to life. And I think, the media did a really great job of recreating that scene. And I tried to do it in the book, but words can't do justice to how horrible that was. And it was like that in hundreds of facilities around the country. This virus just swept through, mostly Ontario and Quebec, because that's where the big populations are. But there was no part of the country that was untouched by this its outbreak in elder care facilities. And again, because they lent themselves so well to this virus, and because we did so little to prevent it from happening.
Yeah, it was extraordinary how similar the stories were about long-term care facilities from coast to coast to coast. It really underlined the systemic nature of the problem. And the Canada Health Act, which I think is probably as pretty close to a gospel as that we have in Canada. You know, every election we trotted out. Monique Bejean ushered it through Parliament in 1985. But there was barely a mention of elder care in that. And so much so, the Canadian Medical Association, as you say in your book, registered their concern at this time by calling that social negligence. And, you know, what is it about a country that allows a piece of legislation to go by without mentioning an entire demographic of people, elder people who we are raised to respect? What happens there? Where's the disconnect?
Well, I think it's just it's a grand illustration of the fact that ageism is just baked into our public policies, into our culture, this taking older people for granted. We saw that. That's a perfect illustration. It's not mentioned in our Primary Health Act. We cover all this acute care, but we don't think of the chronic care that older people tend to need. So that's I think that's the fundamental issue here, is we just don't value seniors. And I think, to me, the paradox, and I talk about it a lot in the book, is I think we do care for people a lot. You know, we all love our grandmothers and our mothers individually, but we have to put that into our public policies. We have to put our feelings and our values for the collectivity, not in just individually. So ultimately, to me, that's what it's about. It's about creating a system that we would expect for ourselves and nothing less. Nobody wants to live like that in those horrific conditions. They don't want to be neglected and forgotten. I call our practices elder apartheid. We literally, when people get a little rickety, we send them off to these facilities, usually which are out by the highway somewhere, out of sight, out of mind. And we literally remove people from society. We strip them of their citizenship, of their dignity. And why do we do that? It's just not acceptable in any way. And I think, I hope a book like this, what it does is force people to think of it in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Neglected No More is nothing if not a comprehensively researched and engagingly written case for improving the situation of elderly people. And, you know, whether that's aging in place or innovative housing or dealing with more home-like facilities. But throughout your book, there's a weaving of, you know, I'm not so sure this will ever happen. You know, I'm not so sure that this can ever be changed. You know, what is it, do you think, that's going to take us there? You know, you and I are roughly the same age. Is it going to happen in our lifetime, or are we going to be sitting in similar facilities when our time comes?
Well, I think we all have to think about that. So I think if we sit here and do nothing about it, yes, it's going to be the same in 20 or 30 years. Depending on the day, some days I'm really optimistic it's going to change. You know, I'm a believer in that tipping point philosophy, and I think we're really close to that tipping point where people are just not going to tolerate this anymore, and it's going to change. When I think of the boomers, you know, the boomers have changed everything in society. They've reshaped our education system, our cities, our highways, our approach to culture. They've changed everything, and I think they're going to change elder care. So that's what gives me hope, is I think this demographic is just not going to stand for this nonsense anymore. Now, what gives me the flip side of the coin on my bad days is, mm-hmm. I go, well, I know there's been 150 reports written about this. I know that we know absolutely everything that's wrong. We know everything on how to fix it, and we just haven't done it. So what's different now? And mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the political environment is different enough to spur change. And then I see some just day-to-day reaction now that makes me feel grim. You know, we had yet another report recently out of Ontario, the Ontario Long-Term Care Commission, which, you know, said everything that's been said before. There was nothing new. That's not a knock on them. There's nothing new to be said. But the response of the government was the most disheartening thing to me. The premier has not said a word about that report. He says all these grand, vague things about we care for seniors. You know, he talks about his mom, you know, et cetera. I'll never tolerate her being treated like that. But when push comes to shove, there's no response. There's no practical investment there. So that makes me feel maybe it won't change. But then, you know, the federal budget had some money, $3 billion for standards. Standards are a really good starting point. So there's good and bad, but I just hope that there's another thing that just pushes over the edge. And I hope that thing isn't another wave of death. I hope it's something else that forces us to do this.
Yeah, because the money being spent in long-term care is extraordinary. I mean, it ranges, as you say in your book, from $1,800 a month to $15,000 a month. So the pool of money that is being thrown into long-term care, it seems like a lot of money. And you have some of the people, some of the families that you meet in your book saying, wow, you know, if I had known it would have cost this much a year, I just would have hired a full-time staff, kept my mom at home and just hired more help to come to the house. What do you think about that?
Well, I think we don't talk about this enough. We don't realize what's coming as we age. We're all in denial. Nobody wants to admit they're getting older, that they might need some help someday. Right. So that's a big part of the problem. We have this assumption in Canada, this naive assumption that because we have Medicare, the system's going to take care of us. We're going to get old. We're going to be taken care of. And then people have this brutal shock, and it usually comes at a time of crisis. There's some kind of crisis. There's a stroke. People start getting forgetful. It's the onset of dementia. And then it's a panic. And then, what? It costs $5,000 a month? Nobody ever told me that. So these things shouldn't be a surprise. So that's a big part of it, is just being ready to have these discussions. I say, you know, the most important Part of this is the discussions we have at our breakfast tables.
Right.
Just saying, you know, how do you want to be cared, you know, with your aging parents, even people my age. I talk to my children. What mm-hmm. happens when things go wrong for me, when things go south? Here's what I don't want. I don't want, you know, I want a DNR. I don't want right. this. I don't want that. You have to have those discussions. The time to have them is when you're healthy. It's not when you're in crisis. So again, we have to take some personal responsibility there. But if we all start taking that responsibility, we're going to quickly realize, yeah, we have to speak up and we have to change. And then finally, on the money issue, you know, everything always becomes, oh, I think we kind of become nihilistic when we wade into this topic. We just say, oh, there's so much to do. It's not doable. It's so expensive. Mm-hmm. It's not doable. And neither of those things is true.
Right.
We literally spend tens of billions of dollars on elder care now, and we just spend it badly. We don't get value for money. We don't get the choice we want. So it's fixable. And then I think what should really give us the most hope is to look to other countries that are very similar to Canada. You know, I talk about in the book a whole chapter on Denmark. Denmark is kind of the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
Denmark has tremendous elder care. They actually spend less on healthcare than we do in Canada. So this is doable. It's affordable. And there's no reason to not do it. So we have to throw off our self-imposed limitations and just get at it.
Right. And I think the government has shown in the last 12 to 18 months, that when it sets itself to do something, it can actually get things done.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the most important lessons of the pandemic is, you know, when we want to do something, we can do it.
Yeah.
And we can do it quickly. The CERB, the Canadian Emergency Relief Benefit, one of the most important social programs in history. We mm-hmm. spent $72 billion. We fashioned that overnight on the back of a napkin, and it's an excellent program. You know, we have such a head start with elder care. We have these 150 reports to tell us exactly what to do. Just throw a little cash in there, throw a little, I think more than money, we just need some political will. And this can be done so quickly and so forcefully. It would be amazing. And I think the politicians who have the backbone to do this, I think will be well rewarded. And I hope they're listening to that.
Yeah. And when people talk about how to do things that will benefit middle class families, this, you know, helping looking after the elders of those middle class families would be a good start. I mean, you have a pretty singular career as a journalist, starting out in student newspapers, and then getting involved with some pretty big health stories, the tainted blood scandal. And as you write in your introduction, that you were covering AIDS before AIDS was AIDS. And you have kept at that throughout your career. And what is it about health policy and healthcare that has really captivated your interest over such an enduring length of time?
I think it's compelling. You know, it's ultimately, it's about people. In journalism, we like to write about people. We like to hope we can, you know, we go back to our student newspaper days that we share in common. We mm-hmm. wanted to be agents of social change.
That's right.
That to me, that feeling still remains alive. That's still what I want to do. Every day, I do lots of teaching now with students, and I tell them every day I write a column, I want to change something. I want to have a practical, I don't want to change the world, but I want to change something. And that's, if you don't have that fire in you, if you don't have a point, then it's just empty words, right? Yeah. So to me, that's what it's all about. I think it's an area you can have an impact. It's one that matters to us. Something like elder care, there's a personal element. You know, I've had two parents with dementia. Mm-hmm. Tell people we're all going there. We're all going to be caregivers and we're all going to be care recipients. So we all have a real personal stake in this, and we should look at it that way. And our children have a stake in it. You know, I don't want my children to have to make impossible decisions like I had to, because my parents didn't talk about things. You know, what mm-hmm. do you do when your dad has dementia and you have to take away his car keys, right? That's something That's one of the worst things that I've written many stories about, that the one of the worst things families ever have to do. But if you're prepared, if you talk about it beforehand, right, it doesn't make it easy, but it makes it way easier.
Yeah. 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 And those student newspaper days are really formative, formative for a lot of us. That's for sure. And one of the things I find particularly marvelous about your career, in a sense of marvel, is that you've received 6 honorary degrees for your work, and from very prestigious institutions, if I could say. And I've listened to some of the convocation speeches that you've given, and anybody can look them up online, you know, Andre Picard honorary degrees, and you'll get your selection. But your message has always been really consistent, and it goes back to that agent of social change youngster you were in university. And you said to medical students as they graduate, treat patients as people and with dignity, use your voice to do good, have a listening ear and a compassionate heart, give patients a better day. And so now we're living in a time where, as you know, personalized medicine means engaging with a patient's genetic material. You know, that's the engagement that the scientists are having, not treating them as a person and with dignity. So I'd love to know where you think healthcare is headed in this country. So my last question to you is a two-parter. One, what direction are we moving in healthcare, do you think? And the second part is, if you were the master of the universe, which direction would you have us move in healthcare?
Well, I'll start by saying, you know, I've been doing this a long time. So this is my 40th year of journalism. Mm-hmm. And in that time, healthcare has changed tremendously, and it's changed for the better. You know, we do a lot of this yearning for the good old days. But I always say to students when I talk to them, you know, I was there and they weren't that good. Right. So healthcare is way better today than it's ever been. And we forget that because we get caught up in the daily failings day to day. So we have to remember that. But we also have to remember that our expectations are much greater. You know, my parents' generation was, well, we got this, so we'll take what we get, and we're lucky, even if it's crappy care, you know, we're thankful it's something. And our generation is not like that. The boomers aren't like that. We're not going to accept mediocrity anymore. And that's good. So there's going to be a lot of change. And there's a lot of dramatic technological change. You know, you talked about personalized medicine. I love writing about genomics. I think it's fascinating, AI, et cetera. But all these things are tools. So when you talked about convocation, and that was convocation speeches are interesting because writing a 5-minute speech takes way more time than a 1-hour speech, you know. So I spent the convocation speech I did at the University of Toronto, I spent many, many hours writing. And that was my message. My message was, what matters to people is not personalized medicine, it's personal. And there's a difference. People want to be treated as individuals, as a person. They want you to understand their conditions. And things like I've written a lot about MAID, about assisted death. And that's a very informative thing to write about. You learn that people come to a point in their lives where they say, what matters to me is quality of life, not quantity. I don't want to live 5 more years if I'm going to be on a respirator. I want to live 3 months and spend them playing with my grandchildren. So you learn, that's one of my stories that has touched me the most in my career, because it's taught me the most about what matters to people. So that's, to me, the future of medicine is this almost contradictory tracks, but they both have to happen. So it's this advancement of dramatic new technologies where we're going to be able to treat you based on your genomic makeup. And we're going to have artificial intelligence giving a constant feedback to tell you if it's working, how it's going to work. So it's going to be all this almost science fiction come to life. And then the other part of it is there's going to be a growing yearning for just simplicity. The home visit, the nurse sitting by your bed, holding your hand, not spending an hour typing into the computer, just sitting there and holding your hand. So I think these are two parallel things that are happening. And to me, they both have to happen, or else medicine's just not going to be as good as it could be or should be. So a long answer, but I do think a lot about this stuff, and I think it's really promising. I really look forward to the future of medicine if we do those two things. And if I was the master of the universe, what would I do? I would actually facilitate that. So I would make it easier for people to have a good life. So I wouldn't put all my marbles in the AI and genomics mm-hmm. field. I'm fascinated in those, but I still think the best investment in health is investing in childcare, making sure people have a decent income, nutritious food, and education. So I'm often asked, if you had $1 billion to spend on healthcare tomorrow, where would you spend it? And I don't hesitate for a second to say I would spend it on making sure that every four-year-old is well-fed yeah. and well-educated and has childcare, because that's going to pay off so, so much in spades down the road.
That's right. The book is Neglected No More. The issue is Elder Care. And our guest today has been Canadian journalistic treasure, Andre Picard. Thank you so much for spending time with us on Talking Up, Andre.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Talking Up. The program was produced by Terry Carter with original music by the 410 Electrosonic Laboratory. Be sure to join us again next week for another inspiring edition. And if you're interested in keeping up to date until then, visit us at thecharityreport.com.